Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Will.
Last year, we released a series of podcasts for the whole month of October, highlighting one film a day throughout that season of horror. And these are films that were introduced by friends of ours.
Yeah, we passed guests. We had people popping up for the first time. They were all over on our Patreon feed, and it was a great collection of films. I thought we could do this year, rather than let them just wither away over on our Patreon, collect them together in volumes.
And this is volume 2.
I hope you liked them, because I think they're great.
Enjoy them.
The goblins will get you if you don't watch out. To take you and shake you until you shout. Stop, look, and listen. It's Halloween.
Hello, listeners. It's Will here. And welcome back to another edition of these Halloween-themed recommendations for the month of October. Today, I've been joined by a guest. And it's none other than my friend and creative collaborator, CEO of, well, co-CEO of Cartoon Saloon, producer, director, Wonder Man extraordinaire, Mr. Paul Young. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Will. So lovely to see you.
I am delighted to have you on the podcast at last.
Yeah, I'm a big fan, you know. I do listen to your dulcet tones regularly. You and Kevin. It's lovely.
I'm not going to ask who your favourite is.
Oh, God, Will, you're my favourite, of course.
Look, listen, it's
Oh, stop it. Stop it.
I don't know. I've never met Kevin. Love to meet him sometime. Sure, he's a lovely fella.
He's a lovely fella. But, Paul, the reason we have you on here is we want friends of the podcast to recommend to the listeners horror-themed films or Halloween-themed films.
Yes.
What is your recommendation for this Halloween season?
My recommendation is Let the Right One In.
Är du vampyr?
Let the Right One In, the Swedish film, directed by Thomas Alfredson, which is one of my favourite films.
Yes, it's a great pick.
Yeah.
2008. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, well, it's one of those films. The reason I like it, it's a vampire story. So they take the vampire idea, the idea of the vampire, and they do a very kind of unique take on it, a very kind of realistic, unique take. Like, take Twilight. I fucking hate Twilight. I don't like Twilight. Right. The reason I don't like Twilight is because I like the vampire. I like reading vampire books. I've always liked the vampire thing as a thing, right? Even developing a vampire show at the moment. So I like vampires. And I like it when people take something, you know, like that, like take something that's a slight fantasy like vampire and say, well, let's just take that as an idea, but put it in the real world. You know, and so Let the Right One In is this gorgeous concept of a little girl who's like 12 years old for about 200 years, you know. So she's like a vampire looking for a new kind of, what do they call it, familiar? She has this old man who's a familiar. And the Let the Right One In about it is there's a little boy next door who he invites her in. And so it's just an amazing movie. So beautifully shot, cinematography and everything.
It's a bittersweet horror tale.
Yeah.
It's gruesome and bittersweet, which is such an unusual combination.
Yeah. It's like, it's almost like a little, it's almost a sort of love story between two characters as well. But also, it's a sort of film you can kind of, at the end of it, you can kind of read it in two ways. You don't know whether she's just a really old lady manipulating a young man, or she's really is this 12-year-old kid who wants another pal. Because you realise at the end, you know, the other familiar, that the old man was probably just like the little boy years ago.
He was a boy once too. Yeah.
And it has these amazing things that I love. And the other movie I was thinking of to talk to you about was Werewolf in London. But the two films have these kind of shots I love in horror movies. What not necessarily they? Horror movies. I wouldn't say this is the kind of horror film I like, because I can kind of watch it and enjoy it without just being freaked out by those. Like, I don't like those slash torture movies or anything like that. It's
jump
not like
scare
that.
Yeah, I'm not interested. Torture porn.
Not interested. I like these ones because they're psychologically quite. It makes you think a lot at the end of it as well. Mm. And they just take the concept of this character who might be living for 200 years in the age of a 12-year-old's body. And and then he just takes it from there, and the script is brilliant. And what would the interaction be like with another boy, little boy next door? Anyway, so there's this shot in it I just always remember and I love. And I don't know if you remember it. And I wouldn't be spoiling anything, I don't think, by mentioning it. Mm-hmm. But he uses this kind of locked-off shot to see her. You never really see gruesome stuff, but you see it from a distance. As if you're somebody across the road and you look across the street and you see something, you go, what the hell was that? You know, so there's this beautiful shot where she does leap from above under this archway in a road, and somebody witnesses a guy walking through, and she sort of jumps down from behind this arch or behind this, in this hall, in this sort of narrow alleyway. You see her just leap on top of somebody and you think, oh God, what the hell is that? Like a spider or something. And it stays away. It kind of stays away for a bit. And it's a bit like that in American Werewolf in London. Do you know when they have that lovely shot? He's after running down the tube station and he hits the escalator, and you see this locked off shot of him just, he's out of breath, and you see him come up. And then it's just at the top of the screen for the first time, you see the bear walking in. And it's just like, oh my God, I'm just about to witness something. So I like films like that choose their shots. And this film really chooses its shots very wisely and like leaves a lot to the audience's, you know, intelligence and imagination as well.
Well, Paul Young, you've done a better job than I could have of recommending this film. You've made me want to watch it again.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we're going to have some listeners who are going to be diving into their DVD collections or splashing out some Apple dollars on whatever to watch it again.
It's a
brilliant film.
It's really what. Now there is I never watched the remake, and I know there was a TV series remake. So be careful you get the right one. It's the Swedish one.
Make sure you get the right one in.
You let the right one into your room. The Swedish one.
There we go. Paul Young, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast at last, and thank you for this recommendation.
Well, thank you, Will. Pleasure.
It's me, but I'm not doing today's selection. Instead, we have a prolific Irish filmmaker to recommend the film for us. He's directed some very recent episodes of the fantastic Inside Number 9, one of the best horror anthology shows that's ever been on television. But his TV credits go way back. He's done almost every type of show you can imagine, in between banging out a bunch of films, his latest one being Apocalypse Clone, a comedy about the end of the world, which just won Best Irish Film at the Galway Film Fla. He knows a thing or two about subverting expectations and playing with tropes, and he's absolutely sound, as evidenced by him doing this for us. So, with no further ado, it's over to you, George Kane, to talk about Young Frankenstein.
My pick for the run-up to Halloween is a film that I watched at Halloween last year, and one that I've seen many, many times since I was a teenager. It's something my dad introduced me to, along with Blazing Saddles and The Marx Brothers, so shock horror, it's a comedy, regularly voted one of the funniest of all time.
It's coming from the deep, dark recesses of the mind of Mel Brooks.
I love him.
Young Frankenstein.
Why can't you hear me?
Sky means business.
Starring Gene Wilder as Dr. Frankenstein.
That's Frankenstein.
Peter Boyle as the monster.
Wow!
Marty Feldman as Igor.
My grandfather used to work for your grandfather.
I'm sure we'll get along splendidly. Oh!
Horace Leachman as Frau Blücher. And Madeline Kahn as Elizabeth.
What do you want to do to me? I'm not afraid of you.
Kill the monster!
C. Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein.
Yes, I think we could all use a good laugh.
But don't see it alone. Don't miss Young Frankenstein, personally directed by Mel Blazing Saddles Brooks, in black and white. No offense.
Young Frankenstein was Mel Brooks' follow-up to Blazing Saddles and was co-written with the great Gene Wilder, who apparently pitched him the idea on the set of their spoof western. It was later Oscar-nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, which is quite rare for comedies. Though it's wall-to-wall with brilliant comic performances, the script actually stays surprisingly faithful to the Mary Shelley novel. The spin here is that Wilder's character, Frederick Frankenstein, or Frankenstein, is mortified by the family's crackpot reputation, widely known for their attempts to reanimate dead tissue. As he declares early on, his grandfather's work was doo-doo. When he inherits the family castle in Transylvania, he gets drawn into his family's controversial research by the bunch of weirdos who used to work for his grandfather. The beautiful Inga, his inconsistently hunchbacked sidekick, Igor, pronounced Igor, and of course, Frau Blücher. One thing that sets it apart is how beautifully shot the film is. Gorgeous black and white cinematography, classic film fonts, and all transition techniques like wipes and irises. A lush orchestral score and amazing production design, which famously made use of the original laboratory equipment from James Whale's 1930 production. As a comedy director, one thing I always admire is a performer's commitment to utter silliness, and being a Mel Brooks movie, Young Frankenstein is incredibly silly. There's the werewolf, their castle exchange, conversations about the monster's enormous Schwanstufer, the panicked horse whinnies every time someone says Frau Blücher, and of course, the famous putting on the Ritz routine, which at first was even too silly for Mel Brooks until Gene Wilder convinced him otherwise. It features three absolutely stellar comic actresses, Terry Garr, Cloris Leachman, and the legendary Madeleine Kahn. Terry is Inga, the beautiful assistant who likes a Roland Zehe. This is 1974, remember? Cloris Leachman is the housefrau who is Victor Frankenstein's devoted girlfriend, and Madeleine Kahn plays Gene Wilder's glamorous fiancée, Elizabeth, who later falls for the monster's charms. In some ways, Gene Wilder plays the straight man to the cast of freaks surrounding him, and he's the absolute king of the reaction shot. Marty Feldman steals the show as Igor, who likes to break the fourth wall. The brilliant Peter Boyle plays the monster. Kenneth Myers from The Producers is the unintelligible and wooden-armed Inspector Kemp. And there's the hilarious uncredited cameo by Gene Hackman as the non-judgmental blind man who tries to befriend the monster with very hot soup. If, like me, you're not really a horror type, then this is an ideal Halloween watch. It's got that wonderful old-school horror atmosphere, a classic story, and a cast of comedy legends at the top of their game. So curl up with a nice mug of Ovaltine and enjoy.
We have a guest with us. Will, who is joining us?
We are joined by none other than the writer of Hole in the Ground.
And the very recent Abigail.
Stephen Shields. Stephen, how are you?
I'm grand, Will. And Kev, how are you guys?
Excellent.
Excellent. So, Steve, when I asked you, do you want to recommend a film for our Horror October Fest? What came to mind? What are you recommending people watch this Halloween?
So the film I'm suggesting for this kind of spooky season is not actually a really spooky movie, but a tremendous body horror science fiction film called The Thing, directed by John Carpenter.
Mayday. Mayday.
Men have just discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside. Where no one can see it. Or hear it. Or feel it.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to. But it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's one.
You guys gotta listen to Gary! He can beat one of those things!
Mm-hmm.
to say it's probably one of my favorite movies of all time. It was a massive hit at the time when it came out because it was the summer of E.T. And so The Thing and Blade Runner suffered a lot. But to me, it's probably one of John Carpenter's best films of all time. Starring Kurt Russell, the film is about a group of expeditionists in the Antarctic. And it's just a great film. It's a great film about paranoia. It's a great film about the human body. It's a great film about disease. And to me, it's one of those films that everybody should see. I know they did a remake of it in later years that I have to say wasn't a patch on this movie. But if I was going to suggest a film to watch a Halloween around the spooky season, it would be John Carpenter's The Thing. I just think it's a tremendous horror movie and an instant classic.
I'm going to second everything you just said. It's a cracker. It's an absolute cracker. It's once you start it, you cannot turn it off. That score is amazing. That dog deserved an Oscar. That's all I'll say. The dog deserved an Oscar.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great movie. It's got great scares in it. It's got great death scenes in it. It's you know, Ennio Morricone scored, great script. It's just one of those my go-to movie if I want to watch a good horror film.
I watch it at least once a year, and I tend to save it for Christmas because it has that vibe that I think, like, if you want to have a spooky Christmas, this is one of the best ones. But I'm gonna go back to it for Halloween because it's probably John Carpenter's best film, and really, it's never not a good watch. And every time I go back to it, I discover something new, like the doctor having a nose ring.
Ah,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, he does, yeah.
So The Thing, then, that's a great pick.
It really is.
Yeah, I think it's one of those movies I think everyone should check out if you've never seen it, because it is really scary and it'll have you on the edge of your seat. You know, it's a real popcorn movie as well, which is always good. And you can't beat Kurt Russell flying a helicopter. It's all good.
And that beard, you could just get lost in that beard.
I'm sure Goldie Hawn did many a time.
Booga, booga, booga. Yeah. Have you ever seen the original? The one that it was based on? The Thing?
Yeah, The Thing from it. Yeah, it's actually a really good movie. I think you can actually get a DVD pack of the two movies together somewhere in the house. But yeah, it's the original's great, but Carpenter's version to me is the be all and end all.
Great pick. So for today, check out The Thing.
Today we have Jamie Hannigan, a frequent guest on the pod, the writer of Pilgrimage and the upcoming film The Damned, to give us his pick, 1973's The Wicker Man.
I have come here from the mainland to investigate the disappearance of a young girl, Rowan Morrison.
That's her name?
You know her?
No, I've never seen her before.
You suspect foul play?
I suspect murder.
We don't commit murder up here. We're a deeply religious people.
Where is Rowan Morrison?
It's the thing inside you, burn and run the Lord. Fire season, fire season, make the baby grow.
You wouldn't want to be around here, our lady. Not the way you feel.
Where is Rowan Morrison?
It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Hail the Queen of the May!
Hail the Queen of the May!
God!
You simply never understand the true nature of sacrifice.
Take the flame inside you, burn and burn the lay. Fire seed and fire feed and make the baby stay.
Hi Kev, hi Will. Look, I'm really sorry, but I just don't think I have the time to record this Halloween recommendation thing. Just between multiple work deadlines and kids and other stuff, I'm just up the wall. So I'm really sorry about this, leave you guys in the lurch. Like, even if I had the time, the thing I was going to recommend is not like it's some tiny obscure horror gem that no one knows about. I mean, everyone knows about this film, even if they haven't seen it. But obviously they should see it. And I mean, now that I think about it, I don't even know if it really qualifies as a horror film, because it doesn't even really get into the horror stuff into the last few minutes. Like, Anthony Schaefer, the screenwriter, he wasn't known for horror. He was a whodunit guy. He was better known for doing Sleuth and Agatha Christie adaptations. And the
thing is loosely based on a folk horror novel called Ritual by a guy called David Pinner, who sold the rights to Christopher Lee in the early 70s. And Lee's obviously a horror icon, but, you know, back then he was at the height of his popularity of doing Hammer horror, but he wanted to do something different. So, you know, although it's considered a classic of folk horror, that's really more down to the setup rather than any overly scary bits. I mean, most of the film is a mystery. This uptight Puritan asshole of a police sergeant getting a tip off that there's this young girl in a remote island in the Hebrides has gone missing. And so this guy, Howie, who's played by Edward Woodward, flies out to see what the story is. And he finds out that the islanders, led by Christopher Lee's Lord Summerisle, have rejected Christianity and gone back to pagan traditions. And again, if I had the time, which of course I don't, I mean, I try to get into why this film is so good, and part of it lies in how cheerful everyone is. The first time you see it, the mystery narrative of where this girl is and why everyone's hiding puts you in Howie's shoes. But every other time you see it after that, you're siding with the islanders from the word go. The Summerisleers, like, they're pagans, sure, but like, they're living their best lives. They're singing bawdy songs in the pub. They're curing ailments with natural remedies, being very forward-thinking about sex education. I mean, they're just a great bunch of lads and having a great time, except for the failing harvest. So there's a lot of best bits, but for me, the most entertaining is any of the scenes with Christopher Lee, who's got this great manner of this genial host trying to be polite with this real jerk, and he never loses his cool. So, like, well, I mean, because I don't have the time to do this recommendation, I don't have to worry about whether or not to spoil the ending. Though that's hard to do considering that it features in every poster and VHS, DVD, Blu-ray cover since the film came out back in 1973. I mean, the title itself is a spoiler. It's called The Wicker Man. I mean, it's not going to end with someone getting stung to death by bees, is it? Anyway, I'd really like to help yous out, but like I said, time's money and so on and so forth. So anyway, good luck with it, and happy Halloween.
Come. It is time to keep your appointment with The Wicker Man.
Hello. So, for today, I am picking a film which I consider to be the best horror film of the 1990s. It's not Silence of the Lambs, it's not The Blair Witch Project, and it's not my beloved Scream. It's 1992's Candyman.
Have you ever heard of Candyman? And if you look in the mirror, you say his name five times.
In cities everywhere.
Candyman.
They whisper his name.
Right. Candyman.
It's just a story.
Candyman.
Candyman.
Just a ghost story.
Candyman.
An entire community starts attributing the daily horrors of their lives to a mythical figure.
The legend first appeared in 1890. He was attacked, mutilated, and burned to death. Poor Candyman.
Helen, a woman died in there. Leave it.
Everyone knows he isn't real.
That's modern oral folklore.
Everyone. Except Helen Lyle.
Where did I get
it? It ain't safe around here.
But I don't scare too easy.
Wanna know about Ruthie Jean? They ain't never gonna catch him. Who? Candyman.
Who is that?
I came for you.
Do I know you?
Now, she is about to discover.
Tell me.
Get out! Get out!
What's behind the mystery?
I'm sick.
What's behind the legend?
Listen, he's under the bed!
And most terrifying of all,
come with me.
What's behind the mirror?
He's here.
Candyman, you don't have to believe. Just beware.
Written and directed by Bernard Rose, it was, surprisingly, his first ever attempt at writing a script, and boy did he knock it out of the park. It was based loosely on a short story by Clive Barker called The Forbidden, taken from his Books of Blood series. Rose took that story and he loosely adapted it, changing the setting from Liverpool to Chicago, and fundamentally changed what the story was about. It follows Helen Lyle, a college graduate doing her thesis on urban legends and local folklore, which takes her on a quest to uncover the truth about the Candyman legend. Say his name 5 times in a mirror and Candyman will get you. The legend of Candyman is that he was an artist and son of a slave who was murdered in the late 19th century, and he stalks Cabrini Green, a notorious run-down housing project in Chicago, which has been knocked since the film, and was also, I was surprised to learn, the setting of the Good Times sitcom from the 70s. The film stars Virginia Madsen, who is just gorgeous on screen, and Tony Todd, who is indelible as Candyman. It was a modest hit. It made about $25 million at the box office in the US, and it went on to spawn 2 sequels and a very recent requel that was spearheaded by Jordan Peele. However, the original, in my mind, is in a league of its own. Funnily enough, Bernard Rose wrote a sequel that was set in England, and it followed Jack the Ripper. The climax involved the Queen of England dining on human flesh, but that so sickened executives that it was turned down. The film has incredible atmosphere. You can see the breath of the actors. I love that frigid, bleak tone that certain horror films have. Child's Play is another one that has it. Maybe it's Chicago, but I love that. What sets it apart from other films, maybe putting it in a similar league to Nicholas Roeg's Don't Look Now, is that there is a pervasive sense of sadness that permeates the whole film. It's a tragedy. It has a haunting score by Philip Glass, who hated the film for years until he learned how much money he made from it. The film was shot on location in Cabrini Green. You feel the setting in which it's set. In terms of slasher films, there aren't that many that can be considered excellent films, but there are 2, for my money, which surpass the genre they're in. John Carpenter's Halloween and Candyman. It's moody, it's morose, it's intellectual and artistic, and more importantly, it's scary as fuck. It's dealing with privilege and class and urban decay and racism, but the film is about an ignorant, if good-intentioned person who uncovers a disturbing truth, tries to deny it, diminish it, and ultimately reckons with it. And like all good tragedies, it does not end well. Although the film is famous for its rules, say his name 5 times and Candyman will come and get you, with his hook for a hand. Characters in the film die without saying his name, so that's just a superstition. That's not the root cause of what's driving Candyman. Denying the past is what causes carnage. I consider it to be the best horror film of the 90s. Let me know what you think in the comments of Candyman. 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 On this Friday the 13th, if you want a recommendation for that series, I would say watch Jason Takes Manhattan. It's the first one I saw. It's my favourite. And it's the best produced. There, I said it. But we're not talking about Friday the 13th today. Instead, we have a guest to make his selection. And it's a guest who was on a prior episode, episode 34 actually, our live show. On that episode, he talked about An American Werewolf in London. And he charmed our live audience. We've been asked many times to get him back on the podcast, but he's a busy man, so we're lucky to get him today. He's directed a number of horror comedies, the latest one being Let the Wrong One In. Prior to that, it was Stitches. He also did one of my favourite horror comedy TV shows, Zombie Bashers, which was hilarious, and I would recommend that you guys check that one out. But today, he's going to be talking about a film that I've only watched once. Not because I don't like it, but because I'm afraid of it. It is a film that shredded my nerves when I watched it. I had to keep pausing the film to prepare myself for what was coming. I was 18, I was watching it during the daytime, and I couldn't handle it. It was so intense and so legitimately terrorizing. It's just one of those films like Requiem for a Dream or Come and See that I endured once, and I don't know when I'll be able to go back and put myself through that again. But it is an incredible film. It inspired Ridley Scott when he made Alien, and it's inspired Connor today to talk about it. The guest is Connor McMahon, and the film is 1974's Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Enjoy.
What happened was true. The most bizarre and brutal series of crimes in America. This is the movie that is just as real, just as close.
Save me! You gotta make it stop!
Just as terrifying as being there.
Please.
Even if one of them survives, what will be left? The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. After you stop screaming, you'll start talking about it.
The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, 1974, was made by the late Tobe Hooper and is one of the most notorious horror films ever made. I first heard about it when the Gardaí arrived down to stop a screening of it at the Irish Film Institute in Temple Bar in the 1990s, as the film was banned here. After that, I made it my mission to get my hands on a copy as soon as possible. The first time I watched it, it had such a visceral impact on me. The sound, the camera work, the editing, the realism of the violence, that chase scene when he's chasing her through the forest with the chainsaw and it just keeps going and going. And she runs through the house, up the stairs, crashes through the window, back into the woods again. I was out of breath by the time the film was over. John Carpenter, when he watched it, said, "It pacified my soul. I went home and slept like a baby." For those who haven't seen it, the basic plot involves a bunch of hippies in a camper van going to stay in a house in the countryside in Texas. They stop at a gas station. They pick up some weird hitchhiker who cuts one of their hands with a knife and then jumps out. He's the first member of this weird family of cannibals we're about to meet, who of course end up living next door to the house they're going to stay in. And one by one they start to get picked off. If that sounds like a bunch of horror tropes, it's probably because the film invented them. The film does have a very simple plot, but what elevates it is how it's made, the images it creates, cinema in its rawest, purest form. The opening crawl of the film suggests it's based on real events, but it's actually not. That was Tobe Hooper's way of commenting on how America was lying to the general public. The film did draw some inspiration from the real-life serial killer Ed Gein, who made lampshades out of people's skin, and who also inspired Norman Bates in the film Psycho. One of the things that adds to the film's scariness is the low-budget nature of it. It really feels like these guys are out in the middle of nowhere on their own, like that feeling they captured in the Blair Witch Project. You really felt like the characters are in danger and are going through hell, which they probably were to some degree. They don't even seem like actors. When I see the remakes and the sequels, they're usually overlit and beautifully graded. And you can almost sense the whole film crew around them in it. They just feel too safe. In the original, you can almost sense the dirt and the grittiness coming off the screen. Apparently, the actors had only one set of costumes, which they stayed in for the duration of the shoot. It didn't help that there was a heat wave in Texas when they were shooting. And when it came to that dinner scene, where the family are all sitting around and they have the final girl tied up, everyone was losing their minds. It took 27 straight hours to shoot, under hot lights, rotting food, filthy clothes. Edwin Neal, who played the part of the hitchhiker, said that filming that scene was the worst time of my life, and I had been in Vietnam. As with most films that are known for their violence, like Reservoir Dogs, there is very little on-screen blood or gore. Most of it is suggested, like the famous scene where one of the characters is suspended on a meat hook. If that was in Friday the 13th, you'd see the meat hook coming through their chest in a spray of blood. Here, the fact that you don't see anything triggers your imagination and makes it seem all the more real. What also makes the kills so shocking is how quickly they're carried out. When Leatherface appears and clobbers the first guy over the head, it all happens so fast, and it's in the daytime. It didn't have that usual build-up of score and suspense that you're used to. I still remember the detail of the guy's legs shaking as he's dragged away. Toby Hooper actually thought he was going to get a PG rating for the film. So the fact that he suggests all the gore through the editing and sound design, it makes it far more powerful in the viewer's mind. You know, suffice to say, he did not get his PG rating. James Furman, notorious head of the British Board of Film Certification, called the film an exercise in the pornography of terror. I also have to give special mention to the camera work in this film. It's often described as having a documentary feel, but it's not shot like a documentary. It doesn't have a lot of shaky handheld camera or anything like that. The film's very stylish, from the opening flashing images of corpses, that dolly shot as they approach the house and it starts to loom over them, the zoom in to all the chickens when one of the girls falls into the room, the long tracking shot in the chase sequence, those extreme close-ups of the eyes in the dinner scene where you can see the bulging veins. It's an amazing use of film language, and it's part of the reason the film is so effective. It also doesn't have a normal score. It's made up of these strange echoing metallic sounds. Toby Hooper was often seen banging on different bits of metal with a hammer to get the desired effect. The sound design apparently took over a year to complete. The film also gave birth to one of horror's most iconic villains. But as terrifying as Leatherface is, there's also something childlike about him. There's a scene after he dispatches of the first one or two hippies where you see him panicking and looking out a window to see if anyone else is coming. He's like a frightened child. It's this extra level of detail that humanizes him and makes him more than just a mindless monster. Some people say the film is a comment on the meat industry. Toby himself said it was about what it was going to be like for the hippies when they grew up and had to face reality. They were basically going to get slaughtered by the real world. By the time the filming on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was complete, the director, Toby Hooper, would turn to vegetarianism.
I'm back. I'm delighted that I'm not here alone. I've got a guest with me who's going to recommend a film for us in this season of horror-themed recommendations. I am joined by my co-writer of Screecher's Reach, the wonderful, the talented, the special, Jason Tamamagi. Jason, hello.
Hello, Will. Hello.
It's great to have you on the podcast at last.
It's great to be on. It's great. We talk so much, and so it's kind of nice to be with you at the podcast.
I think Kevin might be getting jealous of you because I think I speak to you nearly as much as I speak to Kevin over a camera. So, Kevin,
we speak pretty much every day.
We do, Kevin. This is my other camera microphone buddy. So, great for you to finally meet. Jason is a co-writer. He works in Cartoon Saloon. You're a creative director in Cartoon Saloon, Jason. You're a director.
Creative producer.
Yes. You're a director and a writer and a wonderful pixel art artist.
That's a hobby. Yeah.
I love that stuff. I absolutely love it. You're also a big horror movie fan. Am I right?
I'm a huge horror movie fan. I love my horror movies.
Good. So you're the right guy to talk to for these things. Jason, I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you tell us what film you recommend our listeners to watch in this Halloween season?
Yes. So for me, I mean, I feel like it's a bit of an obvious pick in a way, but my pick for horror themed recommendation would be The Lost Boys.
Michael and Sam have just moved to Santa Carla, California. They're about to discover its secret.
Notice anything unusual about Santa Carla yet?
No. It's a pretty cool place. If you're a Martian.
Or a vampire.
When you scream. So where are you? The boy
Sammy, help me!
Stay back! Stay back!
What's happening to me, Star?
Get yourself a good sharp stake. Drive it right through his heart.
You're a vampire, Michael!
My own brother, a damn blood-sucking vampire!
Oh, you wait till Mom finds out, buddy!
When a vampire bites it, it's never a pretty sight.
Michael, they're coming!
From the 80s, I think 1987, I think.
It's 1987.
It's a stone cold vampire classic. And it for me, it's a comfort watch. I can right. put that movie on and just watch it again and again and again and again. And yeah, I love it. And it's horror themed, obviously. It's got horror in it. It's quite gruesome in places. I think people sometimes forget how gruesome it is in a few places. But the thing about The Lost Boys is it's so much fun. It's a fun watch. And I think it's a very easy watch, even for people who aren't deep into horror. You know, it's just a lot of fun.
Do you have a recollection of when you first saw this film, when it kind of landed on your radar?
I was an early teenager. I can't remember exactly what age, but I saw it on VHS. I do remember that, like a worn out VHS copy of The Lost Boys. And I just loved it. And the soundtrack blew me away at the time. I just adored the soundtrack. And I think the whole atmosphere of it, and the soundtrack is a big part of that, I think is such a huge part of the movie. It's an odd movie in the sense that I almost think it's two things in one, but they're seamless. And one is that it's got the kind of late teenage vampire thing, which is so cool and so seductive. There's almost the atmosphere is just kind of it's kind of hot, you know. It's a hot movie in a way, you know. And there's Jason Patrick who ends up kind of falling in with a vampire crowd and falling for a Star who's kind of within this group of vampires. And there is something just very, very cool. Very cool, very hot about this whole thing. But then you've got this other side with Sam, played by Corey Haim, and the Frog Brothers, where there's almost a hint of the Goonies in there. It's younger and it's just leans into the fun and the silliness. And so it's got this, it's both of those things, and it just makes it such a fun watch. It's just, yeah, it's a perfect marriage, you know.
And that take of the vampires, it was, who are represented as this kind of like motley crew, kind of cool, what do we call it? Glam, hair rock?
That's right, hair so metal. Cool. They're kind of like hair metal vampires. And Kiefer Sutherland is just so damn cool in it. He really is. He's one of the coolest characters ever put to screen in that movie.
You are not joking that you're a fan of this, because you've brought this film up to me, I'd say, at least once a week for the last 2 years. And you watch this quite regularly.
Oh, I do. I watch it every few months. Like I just love putting on that movie and... I kind of get more from it each time. And there's so many iconic scenes in it, you know. And especially Kiefer Sutherland bringing Jason Patrick's character in. And there's that scene where he's kind of giving him the food and he's, you know, he sees worms at first, but it's not. It's noodles. They're just noodles, yeah. Michael. You know, it's like there's just so many iconic scenes. And yeah. Or like at the fairground with the big oiled up sax guy. I mean, you don't forget that, you know. That just stays in your memory.
That's where that's from. That's where that meme is from.
That's like, right.
As soon as you said, I know that image. That's in my
head.
That's
right. That's Tim Capello, the oiled up sax guy.
Of course, it's directed by Joel Schumacher, who is, you know, a bit of a legend in his own right for making, you know, films of a vast array of quality.
Yes.
And this is one of the better ones. And it was written by one of the writers was Jeffrey Boehm, who wrote two of the Lethal Weapon sequels, Lethal Weapon 2 and Lethal Weapon 3, and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and Inner Space, and then The Phantom, which kind of came later on. But he had this little window in the late 80s where he kind of wrote some pretty massive blockbuster films.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's... It's one of those films just comes together. You know, it's greater than the sum of its parts.
I agree. So, Jason, thank you very much for sharing your pick with us today. I think our listeners should watch it. I feel like watching it after you described it right there. So, we're going to leave it there. Jason, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Will. Thank you.
Listeners, tune in again tomorrow for another recommendation in this horror-themed season of scary movies. I hope. Today, we have the brilliant Pierce Ryan with his selection, a horror classic from 1958 from Blighty, and it is Night of the Demon. Over to you, Pierce.
Greetings, listener. Imagine you are chosen, singled out to die. Are you the victim of your imagination, or the victim of a demon? Sorry, not sure where that voice came from. My recommendation for this month of horror films is Night of the Demon from 1957.
It has been written since the beginning of time that evil, supernatural creatures exist in a world of darkness. And it is also said man can call forth these powers of darkness, the demons of hell.
It is the night of the demon.
And tonight is the night that Dana Andrews, as a daring scientist, defies the mysterious murderous devil cult in a desperate battle against the demons of hell.
Oh, why did you drop the poker?
Red hot.
It isn't, you know. Oh, my boy, you're as pale as death.
There was something in here.
He has been chosen.
I've been chosen for what? What do you mean?
Today I found all the pages of my desk calendar torn out after October the 22nd. I know why. He died on the 22nd. John, what's the matter?
The same thing happened to my desk calendar after the 28th.
The frightened girl. The master of witchcraft.
You will die, as I said, at 10 o'clock on the 28th of this month. Your time allowed is just 3 days from now.
Skeptical? Don't make up your mind till you see this masterpiece of macabre magic. Because, after all, evil supernatural creatures really do exist.
Adapted from the M.R. James short story Casting the Ruins from 1911. The film was directed by Jacques Tourneur, who also directed the classic film noir Out of the Past, and also a series of low-budget horror films that he made for Val Newton and RKO Pictures, including the highly influential Cat People. The original M.R. James short story Casting the Ruins had at its heart the most terrifying of ideas, the vengeful academic. An occultist who feels his academic papers are not being treated as seriously as they should be curses one critic, causing him to die, and now curses another critic of his work by passing him a piece of paper with the curse, the ruin, on it. His target now has to find a way to quickly return this piece of paper before his untimely demise. In updating this story to the 1950s, the screenwriter Charles Bennett made the central character an American psychologist, played by Dana Andrews, who plans to expose an occultist as a charlatan, only to discover that his powers are real and that the occultist has put a curse on him. That's all you need to know story-wise, maybe too much. This is a film jam-packed with great set pieces, wonderful actors, including our own Peggy Cummins, who grew up in Dublin and is also the star of the utterly brilliant Gun Crazy. Production design is by Ken Adam, who went on to work with Kubrick and the James Bond films, amongst others. Powerhouse Films in the UK have released a terrific Blu-ray of this film, which has a number of different cuts. The American release was cut down from an original running time of 96 minutes to 82, so it could fit onto a double bill. When you start to dig into the extras on that Blu-ray, you'll begin to realise that there's quite a lot of people who have a lot to say about this film. In particular, the conflict between Jacques Tourneur and the film's producer, Hal E. Chester, and the argument over whether the film needed to show the demon at all. Tourneur believed in the Val Newton style of storytelling that you hint at and let the audience imagine their worst fears. Chester believed that no, the audience have paid a ticket to go and see Night of the Demon, or Curse of the Demon, as it was known in the States, so you had to show them the monster. And in a stunning turn of events, especially in the world of filmmaking, you'll be surprised to learn that in the end, the producer got his way. Oh, and he also gave himself a writing credit. When asked about this later, the film's original screenwriter, Charles Bennett, said that as far as he was concerned, if Hal Chester walked up his driveway right now, he would shoot him dead. A vengeful screenwriter. Now there's an idea for a movie. Sorry. However you feel about the monster's appearance, and between us, I actually love the practical effects that are used here. There's a chasing fireball, which is awesome. And there is so much to get from this film. I really encourage you to dive in. When it was released in 1957, it had the misfortune, perhaps, of coming out 6 months after the first colour British horror film, Hammer's The Curse of Frankenstein. Now, there's a film which rejected the idea of less is more and opened up a much more graphic approach to horror filmmaking. And yet, Night of the Demon still holds its own for all of those primal reasons we love horror. The fear of what could happen, or is about to happen. In both the film and the original short story, characters quote these lines from Samuel Taylor Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, describing a man who, having once turned around, walks on, and turns no more his head.
Because he knows a frightful fiend doth close behind him tread.
Sleep well.
Look, listen, it's Halloween.
And here is a clip from the lad's latest Mini Bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon.
Will!
We will! Let's go!
Hello, Poxy Kevin. People think I'm
fucking mad.
No more saying cuss words, guys!
Get fucked!
It's inappropriate and violent!
We can't put these out on the main feed, right?
Hot cock and the c***.
Now where am I to f***? Let me see your hands up!
What? I can't finish the sentence.
Ignorance fucks.
Let me see your hands up.
The best fucking podcast.
Get ready to get fucked. Let's do it.
Mini Bits.
Subscribe.
All of that shit.
You fuck.
Well, you've an awful fucking tongue on you.
Well, listen, it just came out of me. It was one of those spontaneous expulsions that I do every now and again.
You said that you would save the more rotten part of your travel journey for this episode. Do you want to get into that?
Oh, shit. Right, okay. Yeah. Okay, all right, I'll tell you.
Or have you forgotten about it?
No,
it
I do.
2 weeks ago, and you know.
Yeah, I can
that's
tell.
Like
I can,
a fucking lifetime ago.
I can. It was a lifetime ago. So I was due to come back, right? Fly back from Oklahoma on my own, right? Which is great. You know, I love traveling on my own. And we had to leave really early, to leave like at 4 a.m. because it was like a 3-hour drive to where we were staying, to Oklahoma City. So I drove from there back to the airport, It all went grand. It's a bit nerve-wracking driving on the freeway in the middle of in the dark. You know, it's a little bit.
You were driving?
I was driving, yeah. I was doing most of the driving. Yeah. So
really? So you hired a car and you were driving out there?
Yeah. So, well, like, the company had a car, so I was driving it mostly.
Yeah, but you know what I mean.
And so we got there, and I got to the airport. Everyone got through security. Everything seemed okie-dokie. Everyone's fine. Got to my gate really early. Got onto the plane, and we're sitting on the plane, kind of waiting and waiting and waiting. And the pilot comes along, and he's kind of going, "Yeah, we should be leaving now in a few minutes." And
what, he turns up late?
He doesn't turn up. He was there. He was there. But I looked out my window and I saw this guy. I was just kind of above the wing a little bit, and I saw this mechanic underneath the wing looking up at the wing, and he was kind of going, shrugging, going, "I don't know," take pictures of it and stuff like that, and
taking pictures of scratches. I don't know. It's gonna need a lot of body work.
Yeah, kicking tires and all that sort of stuff. And after about 20 minutes, the pilot said, "Oh, we're gonna have to do something about the plane because there's a sensor that says we're broken."
I don't want to take off because, you know, to be honest with you, I'm getting a bad feeling here. But it's up to yourselves. We'll vote on it.
And the pilot says, "Well, you know what? We're going to do the tried and tested method of turning it off and turning it on again."
Right. Nice.
So he went and took him a half an hour to turn it off.
Here, we'll take a run at it and see how we get on.
Yeah, and I was like, I don't feel comfortable about this situation. But I needed to get home. And so that didn't work, basically. And after about an hour of sitting on the plane, or more than an hour anyway, definitely, he said, "Everyone, you've got to get off the plane. Take all your shit, get off the plane." So we went back out to the gate again. And out of the gate,
you put on your shoes and put on your socks.
Everything. Yes, just completely dress up, yeah. All that sort of stuff. And got out of the
gate.
Do
you take your shoes off on a plane?
No, I unloosen my belt. No, I don't. I do unloosen my laces. So, long story short, the plane wasn't going to fly. And there was one woman working at the desk, and she said, "I'm going to call every..." And I knew I had a connecting flight to get back home. So I had like this window, a small window in Chicago to be able to make the connection to go to the other flight. Anyway, I saw the clock ticking because it was about a 3-hour flight up to Chicago. And the woman who was working behind the desk said, "I'm going to call everyone up one by one so we can rearrange your flights." And I immediately said, "That ain't going to work because there's a lot of people here and there's only one of you." And sure enough, it wasn't going to work because it took her about half an hour to deal with one person. And eventually she put like some cards. She put like some business cards on the desk, and she got on the mic and she says,
"Everyone, if you want to go, you know, go try and contact an online customer service advice person, they can help you."
Oh God, it's stressing me out already.
Yeah, and I went, "Oh shit, okay, I got..." And the other thing, it was like an internal flight. So there was a number of old age pensioners there who didn't have a fucking clue what was going on. And they were turning to me because I was like, I give off dad vibes and I didn't have kids on me.
Daddy, chill.
And they were like going, "What did she say?" And she said, "Oh, look, she says we're fucked.
Does this plane stop at Chicago?"
Yeah. So I get, and this one man, I got this, I went up and I took a card and I went, "I got to fucking do this shit." And this little old man came up and he went, excuse me. "Could you tell me what that lady said?" And she said, "There's one of these cards up here. I'll get you one." And she says, "You can contact someone there and they might help you rearrange your flight." And he took it and he read the card. He sat down beside me. He read the card and he says,
"Are you Eddie Marzen?"
Oh, no. What he said was, "This seems to require some sort of smart telephone. And I haven't got one of those."
"Because of the war, the only thing you could get was those big yellow ones, which was the style at the time."
I'm 93 years of age. And I just went, "Oh, man. Oh, you're 93. Listen."
That's terrible.
Yeah, I was like, okay. I said, right, I got it. I said, okay, listen, I'll try and give them a quick call. And once I'm done here, I'll try and help. I'll help you, okay? He was like, "Well, thank you very much." And I got online and I ended up connecting with some guy called Bill, right? And Bill and me had an adventure, okay? So Bill was on the phone. Okay. Bill could see me and hear me, right, through my phone.
This is the teaser now for the episode to entice people to want to keep listening.
You asked me. You asked me.
Spice it up.
You asked me.
Spice it up. Does anyone fucking fight?
You asked me, right? So Bill could see me and hear me, right? And but I could only read Bill's responses on my phone. So it was like 24, right? It was like an
Bill could see you and hear you?
Yeah, he could see and hear me via my phone, but I couldn't.
You were on FaceTime.
So it was effectively like their FaceTime, but I couldn't see Bill or hear Bill. I could only get text messages from Bill because I tried to put my phone to my ear and he was like a little mouse. He was like, you know.
Hello, sir.
And I was like, hello, I can't hear you. I cannot hear you. And then he started messaging me saying, I'll just text you, but I can hear you. And I learned this. And I was like, okay, this is where I am. This is, I'm trying to get this connecting flight. Here's my reference number. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Bill starts messaging me shit like this. He goes, okay, go to gate 5 in capitals now. Right? So I was like, okay, all right, okay. Where the fuck is gate 5? So I just get up, I grab my bag and I just start running through the airport. And I get to gate 5 and he's going, okay, he's messaging me as I'm running going, okay, we're going to go OKEOKOAKIDTAITTDUB. And I said, what are you saying, Bill? What are you saying, Bill?
A-OK on O-A-K.
Yeah.
Who's on first?
What do you mean, Bill? And he says, I'm going to get you to Houston. And then from Houston, you're going to go to Washington. From Washington, you're going to go to Dublin.
He's looking to his colleague going, I got this fucking guy on the phone. Fucking yeah. Diddly eye guy. Doesn't know what the fuck's going on. O-A-K, sir.
So I get to gate, the Houston gate, right? And there was one woman working there and she was lovely. And he said, if there are any people waiting in line, jump the queue. I was like, okay. And he says, jump the queue now. So I was
fight
like
him.
Tipping everyone on the shoulder going, excuse me, I'm sorry. Do you mind if I, excuse me, do you mind? And to be fair to absolutely everyone I met, they all let me jump the queue.
Did you play up your Irishness? Oh, excuse me, dear. Could you get up to the front there? Should I have to get back to Ireland? I don't know where I am at all.
I've got to get back to the potatoes. The potatoes.
I've got Bill on the phone. Bill, they're letting me pass. Oh, God, it's great altogether.
Oh, man. Oh,
you're very good, though. I'll get a bass card for you.
So I get to the lady in the front and I say, lady in the front, hi, I'm on talking to Bill here. And Bill tells me, she says, he needs to get my bag off that plane right now and get put onto your plane. And she was like, well, let's go help you out, sir. And she was like, going, okay, okay, I'm getting in touch with a guy. Okay, they're getting your bag off the plane. And says, right, okay, he's putting into our plane. We're going to get you on this flight, which is leaving in 9 minutes, right? We're going to get you on this flight, sir. We're going to get you on this flight. And I was like, oh, thank Christ. And then she says, oh, there's a problem. And I was like, going, what's the problem? I can't get you unbooked off of the Aer Lingus flight that's taking you home because it's a different, you know, different thing. Anyway, long story short, Bill had to go.
Short?
Like, I know, you asked me. Long story. Bill is trying to get me off the Aer Lingus flight. Bill can't get me off the Aer Lingus flight. And we're sitting there as people are boarding. And I'm asking the lady, I'm saying, how many minutes are left? And she's going, two minutes are left. And then Bill says to me, I'm going to get you on this flight. Long story short, Bill doesn't get me on the flight, but he says, don't you, and he said, you've got to go get your bag. He said, but what I'm going to do, I'm going to get you to LA.
Oh God.
You're going to go to LA and then you're going to fly home from LA. Right.
So did you go to LA?
So now I'm going to LA.
Right.
But first,
oh my God, can I just tell you one of my stories though, just to, you know, mix things up a bit.
What?
So I had to go and I had to get something to eat there at lunchtime. And I went up to, so there's a supermarket up by me and the supermarket, it's Tesco.
Mm-hmm.
And Tesco's up the road. So when I go up the road to get something to eat, I'll go into Tesco. And in Tesco.
Go on.
Sorry. Stop looking at me. Oh God. I was gonna drag that way out. Way out.
I know. You started this train. I'm gonna finish it now. I'm taking this all the way.
And so they have meal deals. No, continue.
Oh shit. Next thing that happens. So long story long. He says, to get on your flight to LA, you need to go back out to the front of the fucking airport, all the way out through departures, go get your bag as if you're collecting it from a flight, and start the whole process of going through security. I go up to the initial check-in
so
counter
go on, tell us
and go through
the
security. So I go right back outside. I'm running now. I've got 25 minutes. The clock is ticking again now. 25 minutes to get the flight to LA. Right. Bill's still with me the whole time. Bill's with me. Bill's telling me, fucking run in all caps. Go, go,
go. Did you have on your wheelies?
I wished I had wheelies, or I wish I had some little trunk that had some sort of scooter that had, you know, electric scooter with me. I go out, get
push
my bag.
Push somebody off one of those carts. Jump on and hijack the cart.
Go back up to the United Airline, you know, check-in desk where he's telling me, jump the queue, jump the queue, jump the queue. I tap loads of people on the shoulder to jump the queue. I reach a United's.
Again, second time. Yeah,
yes, this is what I'm telling you. I had to do the whole process all over again. I finally get to the customer, the lady who works for United's, and I'm holding up the phone and Bill's telling me, tell her I need her assistance. Tell her I need her assistance to get on this flight. And I go up, holding up the phone and says, I'm sorry, our flight was cancelled. I'm talking to an assistant right here. He says he needs your assistance. This lady says to me, sir, this United lady said, sir, you need to finish working with the online assistant before you talk to me. And I says, but Bill needs to speak to you. And she goes, sir, you need to finish speaking with the online assistant before you discuss it with me. And I went, and Bill is literally screaming, hold the phone in front of her face and show her these words. I need to talk to you. You need to help me. I am the assistant. I need your help. And she would not engage. And I just saw Bill typing in small caps,
fuck her.
I apologize. He just said, I apologize. And I grabbed my bag and I walked away. Like he said, that was the last chance. That was the last chance to leave. And I walk away to the corner of the, you know, the big open area, not even the check-in, the outside, basically by the taxis. And I'm just sitting there going, fuck. And Bill is there messaging me saying, I'm so sorry, Will. Bill and Will. And he said, look, I'm going to get you arrange a hotel for you and all this sort of shit. Now, as this is going on...
That was nice of him. So you got home in the end anyway.
As this is all going on, right? There's more.
I just need to tell you, it's 14 minutes.
You asked me.
We have no thing to... But we've nothing to put at the beginning of the episode. We can't put a 14-minute clip at the beginning of the fucking episode.
You asked
it won't
me.
Fit.
Yeah, you asked
it
me.
It won't fit.
You asked me.
I'll have to cut it down to 6 minutes.
You asked me. I need to finish the story. I need to finish the story. This is why you said you had some trouble. And I said, listen, I'll tell you at the next episode, right? So I'm there looking at my phone, right? I'm there looking at my
Jesus
phone.
Christ.
And Bill is messaging me. Bill and me are sharing details.
This is the reverse of me interrupting you. This is where you... I started the story.
I'm finishing the story.
I'm finishing. I'm going all the way to the end.
I am.
And you're going to sit there and you're going to listen. And I'm going to keep going.
And...
What was Bill's surname?
What happened was, as I'm sitting, standing there talking to Bill...
Wachowski.
The woman who refused to... who helped me out... She eventually dealt with all her customers and she kind of, you could tell she had one, she glanced over and she saw me and she kind of started to feel a little bit like, oh, that guy. And she kind of came over and she said, sir, show me your details. She called me over.
Bob's wrong with him.
She called me over, right? And she took my details.
Where's your carer, sir?
She took my details and she was tippy-tappy in the computer. And she looked at me incredulously and she said, but sir... You're supposed to be on the LA flight. You were late for the LA flight right now, sir.
Jesus.
And I said, I know. That's what I was trying to fucking say to you. I fucking know. Like,
I want to strangle her.
Yes. I'll put there's an end to the story. There's another little bit to the story.
But we'll save it for the next episode.
Okay. If you want to hear the end of it, come back to us, right? I will save it for the next set. There is actually another leg to the story. Two legs. Oh, three legs. But seriously, when you asked me, you had trouble. And when I came on the last recording, I was saying, I'm exhausted.
I know exactly how you feel.
Start the timer.
On this episode, we're going to talk about Agatha All Along, The Penguin, The Substance, and Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. So make sure you subscribe to our Patreon, where you can hear us talk about that.
Many bits.